Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. My first guest is Ken Follett, one of the world's most successful authors. He was only 27 when he wrote the award-winning Eye of the Needle. His international bestseller, The Pillars of the Earth, was first published in 1989 and continues to captivate millions of readers all over the world. He's also written the best-selling Century Trilogy, which comprises Fall of Giants, Winter of the World, and Edge of Eternity. Worldwide sales of his book stand at over 170 million copies. His latest, The Evening and the Morning, is the prequel to The Pillars of the Earth, set in 997 CE. Also joining us this evening is Mally Sale, who's had a life really quite similar to her fictional heroine Lizzie. Don't Bother to Dress Up looks at middle age, divorce, dementia, and dating in a very humorous way. The book is filled with tears, laughter, and some very brief encounters. And finally, on tonight's book show is Max Seek, who's a global best-selling Finnish author. His debut novel won the Finnish Detective Society's Debut of the Year Award. The Witch Hunter is his fifth novel and the first in a new series. TV rights have already been bought by a Hollywood production company. The book introduces an enigmatic female lead, Detective Jessica Nimi. That's tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate the words that you could not find. Reaching for something in the distance, so close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions, feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you, only you can let it in. No one else, no one else can speak the words on your lips. Treat yourself in words unspoken, live your life.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now for today's book show is Ken Follett, one of the world's most successful authors. He was only 27 when he wrote the award-winning and international bestseller Eye of the Needle. After writing more successful thrillers, we then had The Pillars of the Earth, first published in 1989, about the building of a cathedral in the Middle Ages. The book continues to captivate millions of readers all over the world. He's also written the best-selling Century trilogy, which comprises Fall of Giants, Winter of the World, and Edge of Eternity. Worldwide sales of all Ken Follett's books stand at over 170 million copies. It's quite incredible. And 30 years after The Pillars of the Earth, we now have the prequel. It's called The Evening and the Morning. Welcome to the book show, Ken.
Thank you, Hannah. It's great to be with you.
It's lovely to have you with us. Thank you for joining us. So, at what point did you decide there was going to be a prequel to The Pillars of the Earth?
Well, my last book was also set in Kingsbridge, A Column of Fire, and I was kicking ideas around for a new story, and I began to think about the period of history 100 or 150 years before the cathedral was built in the Pillars of the Earth, because it's a rather exciting period. There were three powerful groups competing for control of England: the Anglo-Saxons, who lived there, the Vikings, who raided and stole all the time, and the Normans, who were sort of biding their time on the other side of the channel and thinking about taking over. And as everybody knows, it was the Normans who eventually conquered England and ruled for hundreds of years. But at this moment, round about the year 1000, nobody knew how this was going to turn out. And a three-way contest is very good for a novelist, because all kinds of different things can happen. So that appealed to me.
And is it difficult to research this far back in time? I mean, there must be limited resources and information about what it was like to be around back then.
That's true. The Anglo-Saxons didn't write much down. They didn't build very many stone buildings. And they didn't leave very much behind. So, yes, it was quite difficult. And I get a lot of inspiration from the sort of details of everyday life in the past. But there were some sources of information. And one of the most fruitful is the Bayeux Tapestry, which is a work of embroidery done to celebrate the Norman conquest of England. A lot of it is a strip cartoon. It's 60 yards long, and it shows in panels, just like a strip cartoon. It tells the story of the Norman conquest, but it also shows us a lot of everyday events. Shows us people having dinner, people chopping down trees, people on horseback a lot, people with their dogs and their falcons, and that was a particularly useful source of information. It's the tapestry itself, amazingly, survived 1,000 years, and it's in a museum in northern France, in the city of Bayeux. And there's also a copy in a museum in England, in Reading. So I was able, I went to see both, and I did have, throughout writing The Evening and the Morning, I had on my desk beside me a booklet which has small reproductions of every one of the panels of the tapestry. So I was able to refer to it. And you know, if you can get books about what they wore in the 11th century, and you know, what their dining utensils were and all that kind of thing, but to actually see them as pictured at the time is very convincing, isn't it? So I found that absolutely marvellous.
Yes, it must be so wonderful to be able to collate all this information together and then really imagine what it was like to be around then. Have you been able to do that?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think that's, you've put your finger on the essential thing, because the reader has to really feel as if they have visited this place and time. And, of course, the broad picture is very important, but the little details often strike us about times in the past. It's often the little things that make us realize how different life was for the people then to our life today.
Yes, it's really hard to imagine, isn't it? I mean, it's one thing going back 50 years, even 100 years, but when we're talking that many amount of years, it's so hard to visualize, isn't it?
Well, yes, but my basic philosophy is I don't really think that people's nature changed much in 1,000 years. Their lives, of course, their lifestyle changed absolutely radically. Their houses and their clothes and their food and all that has changed. But I believe that people in the past were always concerned about the basic things that we're all concerned about today, like love and marriage and the family, work and money and war and violence. These are basic things to all periods of history. And I think if you write a novel which is based on those kind of anxieties, those kind of hopes and fears, then you can be true to the past and at the same time really engage 21st century readers.
Absolutely. And do you spend a lot of time doing the research? Is it difficult sometimes to tear yourself away from the research or get writing, or have you got that down pat now?
Got it down pat. I spend about a year preparing before I write chapter one. And when I say preparing, I mean researching and planning the story. It's important to me to plan the story very carefully. And I write a detailed outline saying what happens in every chapter. And I go over it again and again, improving it and making sure that there's always something happening. I don't myself like novels that have long boring bits in them. I try to make sure there aren't any of those in mine. And the planning and the research go together, because one day I might think of a new scene that would be interesting and exciting and then realize I don't know enough about some subject to write that scene. So the next day I'll read a book about whatever that particular topic might be. And reading the book as well as answering my questions will also usually give me ideas for further scenes in the story. So the things grow together organically. The research and the planning feed off one another.
That makes sense. And I have to ask you, going back in time a bit, after writing successful thrillers, then The Pillars of the Earth was really quite different to things that you'd written before. Where did that whole inspiration come from for that?
It came from the cathedrals themselves. You know, I had, in my early 20s, I'd started to be interested in the medieval cathedrals and going to visit them and reading about them. And I was particularly interested in the people who built them, because the question that occurs to pretty much everybody sooner or later about cathedrals is, why are they here? Why did medieval people want one of these? You know, it was not an easy decision. It was very expensive. It was very hard to build because they didn't have, the modern physics and mathematics for working out the stresses in a building like that. It took a long time. And the people who built these magnificent buildings themselves lived in wooden huts and slept on the floor. So it's kind of a paradox. And I was interested in how and why the cathedrals were built. And of course, there is, on top of my sort of curiosity, there is something rather wonderful about the fact that people who were so poor and hungry built the most beautiful buildings in the world, and buildings that lasted hundreds of years. It's a case of human beings rising above their circumstances to create something that's perhaps eternal. And that is, I find that idea, and I find the fact that human beings do that, inspirational.
Yes, very much so. And when you had such success with The Pillars of the Earth, obviously you've had a lot of success since, but was there always a kind of pressure to create something that was so well received as that book?
Well, yes, there is, but I don't really mind that, you know. I don't resent it, and it doesn't make me worry. It perhaps it makes me a bit more perfectionist, and I, you know, I think about the way people talk to me about the pillars of the earth, and some of my other books as well. Eye of the Needle, people often talk to me in a very, very, very enthusiastic way, and I think, well, now that person, having enjoyed those books, will be really looking forward to the new one, and I've really got to make it lives up to their expectations. And so I'm the pressure on me is not to slack, not to ease off, not to write something and say, well, it's not very good, but it'll do.
Yes.
And the thought of a lot of people looking forward to the book absolutely stops me from doing that.
So it's good in a way, that pressure.
I think it's good, and it, you know, it doesn't keep me awake at night. It doesn't give me...
That's good.
I don't worry.
Yes. And you must have seen a change in since the invent of social media and everything, the fact that readers can contact you in a way that wasn't possible 30 years ago. You must get a lot of feedback from your fans.
Yes, and I like that very much because, you know, my aim is to make them happy. I have friends who are writers who say that they don't write for the readers, they write for themselves, and if the readers like it, that's fine, but that's not what they've got in mind, and I'm the opposite of that. I think all the time about the readers. I think, will they believe that this could really happen? Or, you know, will they think it's logical? Will they think it's interesting? Will they turn the pages? Will they feel emotional about the story? I think about that all the time. A lot of writers don't, and some very good writers. I mean, this isn't a criticism of my colleagues. A lot of very good writers just have a different approach to mine. But I think about the readers all the time.
And have you already planned your next book? At what point do you have a rest in between, or do you already know where you're going?
I don't much like rests. When I finish a book, I tell myself I ought to take 2 weeks off and not do any work. But after about 10 days, I start to think about the next book. You know, the fact of the matter is that the whole art of fiction is so absorbing, and it's what I've loved. You know, long before I thought of writing novels, I was an avid reader, and this is true of most novelists. I love stories, I love fiction, and you know, it's the most interesting thing in my life, and I don't really want to take time off from it. I want to get on and do it again, because
yeah,
it absorbs me.
That's nice. And would you say your writing style has changed throughout the years and the way you write books, or did you find a way that worked in the 80s and continue to do it today?
Well, I think it changes slowly. In the years when I was writing books being published and weren't bestsellers, I learned a lot, and much of that came together with Eye of the Needle. And then I did have, at that point, I had a clear style and an approach to writing thrillers. It all changed again when I embarked on The Pillars of the Earth, because it was a different project, much longer than, I mean, that's the main difference. Writing a long book is very different from writing an average length novel. You know, the ordinary novel is generally about 100,000 words, and my historical novels have been between 300,000 and 400,000 words.
Gosh.
So you've got to keep on making up more and more stuff about the same people.
Yes.
And that's a challenge. But it is, of course, more satisfying as well, because you get to know these people and their milieu, their town and their lives. You get to know all of that much more deeply, and readers find it very satisfying if it's good. Of course, we all hate a boring long book, don't we? If a book is boring, we would rather it be short. But if we're enjoying it, we want it to keep going on and on. And I've had letters from people saying that they wish the Pillars of the Earth was longer, which is a bit of a surprise because it's already 375,000 words. but also about, you know, a very nice compliment. Yeah. So, yes, I did. I had to learn a lot in order to do the Pillars of the Earth about writing longer novels, and you know, maybe something else will come up that makes me go back to the beginning and learn to write another kind of book. Who knows?
Yes. And just one more question, going back in time to the period that you're writing in, so 11th and 12th century, with all the research that you've done into that time, have you ever thought that it would have been a lovely time to have been alive? Can you see that it would have been a great time to be there? Or are you very thankful that you were born into the century that you were born in?
The second, actually. I don't think I would have liked to live in the 10th and 11th centuries at all. I am pretty fond of the comforts of life, you know, a warm house and a soft bed and you know, cashmere sweaters and that kind of thing and good food and wine. And no, I living at a time, the main alcoholic drink in the Anglo-Saxon period was made of fermented honey. And so it was very sweet and very alcoholic, and apparently people used to get completely legless on it in the Anglo-Saxon period. And I suppose that's because, you know, sweet things always go down well, don't they? And so they must have gone glug, glug, glug with this very strong honey wine.
Yes.
And but it doesn't appeal to me at all. I like a nice dry white, you know.
Yes, absolutely. Fair enough. Well, if people want to get a copy of your latest book, it's called The Evening and the Morning, and it is the prequel to The Pillars of the Earth. It's available to buy on our website, tre.radio, in the bookshop section there. It's by Ken Follett, who we've had the pleasure of chatting with today. Ken, thank you for joining us on Talk Radio Europe.
Hannah, enjoyed talking to you. It was a pleasure.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Mally Sale, who's had a life really quite similar to her fictional heroine, Lizzie. The book is called Don't Bother to Dress Up, and it looks at, in a very humorous way, middle age, divorce, dementia, and signing up to a dating website. Welcome to the book show, Mally.
Hi, Hannah. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's a real pleasure. It's lovely to have you on. And I'm going to be honest straight from the start and say that I've already been reading your book and I'm really enjoying it.
Oh, thank you. I hope you're laughing more than you're crying.
I am. I have done both, I have to say. I have been laughing out loud and I have had a few tears as well, because when you're talking about your mother and the dementia and everything, some of the stories are both funny and sad.
Yes, I know. It was an extraordinary time in my life, I have to say. And I started off in real time. I didn't do internet dating for 3 years. But when I started it, it was all mum has dementia, dad is quite clearly galloping towards dementia. And it was just full on, really, just full on. But we did laugh a lot as a family. Even my mother laughed sometimes.
Because she was very, just trying to think of the right word. Well, she was quite sort of loud and forceful and opinionated and said what she felt, even if she wasn't really quite sure what she was feeling or why.
But a lot of people who have a relative with dementia will tell you that they lose their inhibitions. Mm. And my mum was shy. It was always my father at the forefront. My mum would be in the kitchen putting on the kettle or cooking for everybody, or she was a great feeder, but very shy. And then to suddenly hear somebody that, as children, we'd be told off for saying bloody. This is a woman that's telling somebody in a shop to piss off. And you just go, Mum, what did you just say? But it got worse, as you will see in the book. It just horrendous, you know. I'd visit her in the care home, and when she eventually had to go into care, And I'd say, how are you, Mum? Did you have a lovely sleep? How can you sleep when they're all having sex? And she would be very descriptive. And then I'd have to say to the manager, I hear you're having sex again, all of you. Yes, that's us. Yes, we're all at it.
Well, so she was really a completely different person then to what you'd used to.
But she was so ballsy, for want of a better word. I mean, she literally, in the end, escaped from home. Silly expression, but escaped from home and ended up in the most extraordinary places, like Southampton. She nearly got on a liner to New York, but the giveaway in the waiting queue were her slippers and her jar of sixpences that she was going to pay for her tea with. And it's just, part of it you're thinking, yay, go, Mum, go. And the other part is thinking, oh, dear God, what are we going to do? I'm so busy, I can't really afford to even put petrol in the car to go and see them. And everything was a drama, really, but with laughter.
Yes, and it was difficult with your dad because your dad wasn't able to communicate, was he?
No, he had some sort of mini stroke. He described it as an excruciating pain in his head. And then his speech deteriorated a lot to the point where his last words were bloody women, and that there was a sort of shutdown. Those were his final words. But that was really heartbreaking because he, within seconds of walking into a room, he could make people laugh. He was such a funny guy and so popular. And grandchildren loved him, and my children loved, everybody loved him. Mm-hmm. So he went from this over-the-top comic, mucking in sort of person to really depressed and silent. And it was heartbreaking because you're communicating with him, telling him this is what we're going to do with Mum, but you didn't know whether he was fully understanding. So you did everything on writing it down as well so that he could look at it, even though you weren't there. And it was just juggling. And the one thing I lost my temper with my sister about was, in the middle of all this, she thought it would be calming to get Mum a cat. And it was the cat from hell.
Oh.
It wouldn't go near Dad. It wouldn't go near anyone except Mum. And, of course, in Mum's head, she this was her best friend. And there were dishes of cat food and fish all around the house. It stank. And there was Dad sitting at his computer, at his little desk, just typing out notes to people. And they were all muddled notes. But, no, it was a heartbreaking time.
And you share a lot of the notes and emails and things that he wrote in the book. And he was a man of few words in his notes, but said exactly what he explained it perfectly in sort of five words, what was going
exactly.
on.
I know. Mum, mad.
Mum, mad, gone.
Yeah.
Knew exactly what he meant.
Yeah. Help, Mum, mad was another one.
Yes. Oh, gosh. So part of the sort of catalyst for this story and your life changing and being turned upside down is after 34 years of relatively happily married life, you received a bit of a bombshell that your husband was, well, basically having an affair with someone else and someone much younger as well.
Yes. It honestly, we laugh a lot now. Well, we laughed a lot. Everything is about laughing to get us through it. But it really was completely unexpected to get a call on a Monday morning saying, can you meet for lunch? And I said, yeah, fine, I'll make time. But it's got to be a pub nearby because I'm really busy. And met him in the pub.
didn't cross my mind. And he just said, I have to tell you, I've got a business partner. And I thought, fine. Why are you running that by me over a lunch that we can't really afford anyway? And he said, and she's from Poland. And, you know, I'm not the fastest person in the world. It's got to be said, picking up on these things. And I thought, right. And I thought, well, maybe because she doesn't charge a lot for running a business. And he said, in fact, she's my soulmate. I mean, it took that for the penny to drop.
Oh, and, gosh.
And I said, she's your soulmate. What? Where did you meet her? I met her in the, I don't know, it's Park Lane, Piccadilly, somewhere, club where he was going for a massage every week. I looked it up afterwards. It was £95 a session.
Oh, gosh.
And we were struggling to pay our mortgage. And anyway, that's not the point. But I just literally, instead of punching him between the eyes, I just picked my bag up, said, thank you for telling me. I wish you all the best, and walked out. And even when I was walking to my office, I'm thinking, I'm going to divorce him. I'm going to sell the house. I'm going to find a little place, you know, even if it's just outside. And I was just sort of planning all this. There was none of this, my heart has been broken. How can I carry on? I must go and fall at his feet and beg him. And the other bizarre thing was I set up a new account because I knew he had the passwords for all my various accounts online. And it asked for a password, and I typed in freedom for no reason, no rhyme or reason. And, you know, I thought this is actually what I've been waiting for. So,
oh, a blessing in disguise.
Yes, little fat bald git.
You say it like it is, absolutely. Yes. And you have three kids, well, they're not kids exactly, but three children. And you moved in with one of them, Emma, at the time after selling the house. And that was also very interesting for very different reasons.
Well, yes, I'm my youngest. We call him John John. He'll kill me for saying that. Johnny. Was at university, and Georgie, the middle one, and Emma were striking out. Georgie had some wonderful job, and Emma had turned round to us and said, come and look at my website. This is when we were still in the house, and we went, my husband went in first, and I could hear him yelling at her, and he said, Mally, come and look at this. I went in. I honestly thought it was a nightclub. And I thought, well, there's nothing, you know, if that's the path she wants to go down, there's no point shouting at her. And he said, you stupid woman, look at it. It's running orgies. And I, oh, God, Emma. And she said, well, this is what I want to do. And she explained why. And anyway, the long and the short of it, I found myself homeless. And of course, this was all within months, Emma starting up her business, me losing my home. And I literally had nowhere to go. So Emma said, right, the girl who's been renting my room is moving out, the spare room, you're moving in. And I literally had no other choice. Moved in. And honestly, she actually said to me when I arrived, there's going to be no sobbing in this house, Ma. I can't be dealing with it. I'm too busy. And you've got to pull yourself together. Here's an iPod. Plug it in. Here are some old trainers of mine. And here's a bike. I don't know where she pinched that from, but here's one. Get out there, either walk it off or cycle it off. But we've got to turn this around. And if I find you're anywhere near a man, I'll get really cross. It's got to be girlfriends, girlfriends, girlfriends from now on. And she was absolutely right. And she did turn my life around.
Oh.
And my other two were just wonderful. They were on the phone. My son would ring and, saying, I'm on suicide alert. How are you doing today? And Georgie would always be, are you eating properly? What are you eating? What exactly have you been eating today? Right, I'm bringing you this, and this. And they were just really fantastic.
Amazing. Sounded like, I mean, just what you needed, and all very different as well.
Yes. But living with Emma had its challenges. It's things that everybody's just got to remember that I'm not your generation. We're the generation where I told my parents after, 5 years of marriage that I wasn't in love, and they told me I had to get on with it or I'd let the regiment down. And then I told my nan, who I was very, very close to, that I couldn't take it anymore. And she said, you've made your bed, you've got to lie in it. And these men are men, they're not very nice creatures, but work your way around it. So that's my generation. So I'm in a flat now with Emma. But finding everything hysterically funny from, first of all, arriving, and she was in a basement flat, and the third and fourth steps were missing, literally missing. So I was getting cross because if I forgot, then I'd fall down the steps, or I'd have to take this giant setup just to get to the bed. And she'd just be saying, oh, for God's sake, somebody's coming to fix it. Get him. I mean, from irritating things like that to laughing my head off over the sort of people coming into the flat for interviews, or I've answered her phone because she's in the shower and it's somebody. It's all very well having mud wrestling, Emma, but where are we getting the mud from that's not going to set? And then another call, how many dwarfs do you want? And I'm thinking, I'm an events manager, but these are questions that have never been
And yet, when she was first starting up, you and was it your sister or friend started doing some catering for them, which was an experience?
That was my sister.
Yeah.
You see, we're 10 years apart. She's younger than me. I hate her. And we became very, very close once all of this kicked off. So she was the only one I could really trust to cope with it with me. And it was just extraordinary. And we made a list of rules because, well, first of all, they were in country houses. Emma is now branching out from people's houses in London. But, of course, the catering costs an absolute fortune. And without thinking, I said, if it's 40, 50 people, I can cater for that. I've been doing it all my life. You're on, she says. And anyway, we did an Ocado. It all arrived, and my sister and I arrived at this place. But we gave Emma a list of rules. Nobody, especially naked, comes into the kitchen, apart from us maybe getting excited. It's slightly off-putting if you're chopping a carrot, that's what we said. And nobody's to walk in anyway through the kitchen. And it was hilarious because all the rules were now out of the window. No naked people came in, but people were coming in saying, have you got needle and thread? My dress is giving way. And of course, my sister is just hilarious. She says it how it is. She's muttering, I'm not surprised, it's wrong bloody size.
Yes.
Yeah, maybe a size up, dear. And then another woman came in and said, excuse me, do you have any lime and apple something or other? And my sister just said, what are we, the Ritz?
Oh, dear.
Somebody came in and asked us for something and got short shrift. And she went out and said to Emma, "My God, your chefs are angry people." And but we were absolutely exhausted. And we were known as the angry chefs after that.
Love it.
Yeah.
There was a moment, a great story when, again, quite near the beginning, I think, of Emma setting up the company, when she borrowed your car and you got it back and she'd left some boxes in the back. And tell us about that.
Oh, my God. Because I had this is a little battered, I say battered, that's Emma's fault, a little battered Beetle car, a Volkswagen, and it was my one link to getting to Bournemouth, where my parents were, in a hurry. And so I needed to know where it was at all times. And a couple of times I'd gone out in a hurry and Emma had parked it three streets down or something at 4 a.m. or whatever. And she asked to borrow it. She needed to take a whole load of stuff to this venue. I said, "That's fine, Em, but please park it roughly where I left it or leave me a note to say where it is, because I'm off to see Nanny and Grandad tomorrow morning first thing." And yeah, Ma, don't worry, and I'll put the keys on the side. That's fantastic. Saw my car there, saw the keys, went to put my little overnight bag in the boot. It's full. It's full of boxes and bottles of champagne, literally sort of not boxed up, so bloody annoying. I left the front door open, carried all the bottles in, carried some other box in. I think he had masks in or something. Carried in a few wigs that were chucked on the straws. And I was quite tempted to wear one, actually. It's stunning. And then this last box, lifted it up, and the bottom of it caught on the latch thing of the boot, and the bottom ripped, and out spilt all these glittery packets of after-dinner mints. So, bloody hell, Emma, I start shoveling them up back into this box, and I suddenly realise, to my horror, they're not mints, they're condoms. So I'm in quite a busy road in Wandsworth with hundreds of glittering condoms spilt out onto the road. And along comes this lovely guy who says, "Oh, my goodness me, I can help you with that." I went, no, it's fine. Thank you. Back away. It's all right. I've got this. No, you can't possibly have, and you'll kill yourself if you keep stepping out into the cars. No, I'm leaving those because cars have driven over.
Oh, God.
Nobody wants a crunched up condom. Well, sorry. And he starts shoveling them back into the box with me, real sweetie. And I thought, I can't cope with this anymore. I'm going to be physically sick. I'm so embarrassed. So I said to him, "Do you know what? I'm just going to leave the rest and just plonk this box inside. There's only about 100 left on the road." And he went, "Oh, well, if it's all right with you, I'll put some in my pocket and have them later on this evening." And I just said, "Knock yourself out." Yeah, and actually, I was so embarrassed. I left the box in the boot, drove to my parents' house with a box full of condoms, praying that I didn't have an accident or stopped by the police. "We'll just look in your boot, madam, while we're here." All this isn't so weird for you, but if you add my age to...
Oh, no, it's quite weird for me too.
Oh, really?
Well, I'm just picturing this guy when he got home and makes himself a coffee and thinks, "Oh, I've got those mints," and then opens them.
I know, but I mean, where Emma is so laid back, I said, "I think he lives about 5 doors down, Em. Maybe you should go and say something." She said, "No, who knows, he might have used them. Leave him alone."
Yeah, it's no need to embarrass him.
Two different ways of thinking.
Yes. Well, it's a great book. I'm really enjoying it. I haven't quite got to the dating bit yet.
Brace yourself. Actually, one that a girlfriend said I should have put in was some guy I stupidly, it's not in the book, I stupidly slept with. He woke up in the morning And yes, we had sex. And then he got out of bed and he stuck a tissue on the end of his willy. Okay, penis, Em, I'm saying penis. And walked around like that. It was like somebody waving a white flag.
How and weird.
But honestly, he was checking his phone. He was putting the coffee machine on. And the whole time waving this white flag. And I had to sit, just put the duvet over my
Oh, people are funny.
He's known as Tissue Man, but we haven't included him because I didn't want to embarrass him.
No, fair enough. Just talk about him on the radio instead.
I disguise my voice now. Yes. How are you doing?
No one will ever know. Don't worry. Well, if people want to get a copy of Don't Bother to Dress Up, it's a really great read, and it's by Mally Sale, who we've been chatting to. Did you enjoy the actual writing of the book, Mally? Do you think you might write more?
I've started taking notes for a second book because I left Yorkshireman hanging, and I need to follow up from that, and there's a lot of tears and laughter in that as well. So I'm not going to spoil the plot.
No.
But no. Yeah.
But there's going to be a part two.
Yes, a part two.
Oh, exciting.
It's just, the reason I wrote the book is to make people going through the same thing realize that they have got the strength to do it, and they will laugh, and it does end, you know, especially with your parents. You've just got to go with it and don't use the, she doesn't recognize me anyway, so I'm not going to see her. They're inside their own heads, and they can see you. They can't remember your name. They might not even remember you're a daughter, but they know inside that they've connected with that person. So don't just leave them in a home because it's so unkind. Mm. And don't put me in a home. over the bridge for me, please, chaps.
You've said it now.
Yes.
Mally Sale, it's been really lovely chatting with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's very kind.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from Finland is Max Siek, who's a global best-selling Finnish author and Scandinavia's most exciting new thriller writer. His debut novel won the Finnish Detective Society's Debut of the Year Award. He's with us on the book show to talk about his latest book, The Witch Hunter. It's his fifth novel and the first in a new series. Welcome to the book show, Max.
Great. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us. And this is exciting then, a new series. So have you already planned how many books there's going to be?
Well, I'm a big fan of three books and like trilogies. And the first three books was a trilogy. And then I started, actually, The Witch Hunter is my fourth novel. And I just, the fifth one just came out in Finland. It's called The Evil's Net. And that's also going to be translated into English and many other languages, but only next year.
So this is going to be three books then, the Witch Hunter series.
I think that's pretty likely to be a series of three books. But however, I haven't decided yet. So if I really like the characters after three books, I might just go on, and it also depends on how the books sell abroad and how people if people want to read more about Jessica Niemi, who is the main character in these books, then I might just as well keep writing about her.
Yeah,
I haven't really decided yet. So
okay, so what can you tell us about Jessica?
Well, I think Jessica is she's a 35-year-old female detective, a Finnish woman who investigates really strange and creepy crimes. I think she's not perfect in any way, and that's what makes her, pretty, I think, relatable. I think she's amazing in the sense that she has, dark secrets. She has committed a crime on her own a long time ago, and she's also really wealthy, and she's basically just living these two separate lives. She has a lot of money, but she doesn't want anybody to know about it. You know, she doesn't want to know. She doesn't want that people in the police force know that she's actually wealthy. So she's basically just trying to seem like a really ordinary person, even though she's not.
And what is she like as a detective? How good is she at her job?
Well, she's really good. Obviously, because she's the main protagonist in the book. I wanted to make her not perfect as a human being, but she's close to perfect what comes to investigating crimes. And what I forgot to mention previously is that she's struggling mentally. She has these issues, mental issues, not dramatic, but she keeps having nightmares about her past, about her mother. She tends to talk to her dead mom even during the daytime. She knows the difference between what is imaginary and what's real so far, but she's also afraid that at some point in her life, you know, it will become more unclear to her what's real and what's not. And she's afraid of becoming, you know, crazy. So that's what makes, I think that, you know, makes her even better detective.
Yeah, sure. So tell us, without giving too much away, obviously, a bit about what happens in the book.
With the witch hunter. That's basically, it starts with a dead body found in a really huge house in a really nice neighborhood. And it turns out that the dead body is the wife of a really famous crime author. And the point of the whole book is that somebody's copying the murders from this really famous crime author's books. So the really creepy part, the creepy fact is that the author's wife is murdered exactly the way people are murdered in the author's book. So somebody's copying the murders, and that's pretty much the starting point for the novel.
Yeah. And she works out or realizes that it can't just be one person as well.
Yeah, the thing is that the author is called Roger Koponen, and you know, they just happen to open his books, and it turns out that the book starts similarly with this kind of murder, but there are six or seven more to come, so they can basically predict what happens next, and it's really that's what's crazy about it. So they can just read the book and pretty much see what's to come.
Creepy stuff. Yeah. Dare I ask where you get your ideas from?
Well, that's a good question. People who know me good, who know me well, like my friends and my family and stuff, they have asked me, they indeed have asked me, like, if I have like some trouble, how can I come up with ideas like this? But then again, I mean, I'm a huge movie fan, and I've read a lot, and I'm not a big fan of terrible things. I don't really watch horror movies, and I don't like the gore. And I tend to, you know, I'm afraid of really scary things. Like if I read a really scary book, then I tend to be afraid. So I think this is more like it's maybe my own nightmares, like things that I have thought about and I'm afraid of that might happen to myself or my, you know, people who I love, and that's something I just want to write about. I think it's those are just ideas. I write about things that I'm afraid of myself, I guess. And the main, you know, the main idea is to entertain people. I think this is entertainment, and it's definitely, I try to, you know, watch more movies and read more to get more such ideas.
Yes.
To write more books.
And I understand that you've got a lot of material for writing from the military service that you did.
Yeah, it was a long time ago though. I think it was 15, 16 years ago. So yeah, indeed, I got ideas for, you know, how the police might operate. I mean, I learned to use guns and explosives and tactics and all that, but so if I write like a action sequence or something where it's essential how to describe how people are using guns or whatsoever, yeah, then definitely. It's a long time ago, and many things in life have inspired me as well. So not only the military service, but I think every, you know, occupation and every year I learn something more, and it helps to write.
Mm. Well, if people want to get a copy of The Witch Hunter, it's the first in a new series, and it's available on our website, tre.radio. It's by Max Seek, who we've been chatting to. Max, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, and hope you like the book.
The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this program, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels, and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.